We do the profiles of new members in our bulletin so that you can get to know a number of things about people who join this church, can find kindred interests and the like. And I would like to urge the members of that last large class to please send me their profile data. Scott and Kelly Christensen are, as you were told, profiled today. You'll have an opportunity to find out who the other person is who laughs on Sunday morning when no one else laughs. There are two people like that. Scott is one of them, and there is a lady in the choir who is trying to be loyal to the home front, who is the other. One thing we find out as we get older is that some of the things we learned as children are not very accurate. George Washington probably did not sail the silver dollar across the Potomac, and Lincoln certainly did not tell all the droll stories that have been credited to him. I grew up thinking that the Pilgrims, dressed only in black, with high-peaked hats and bright buckles on their shoes. More often, I am told now by those who should know, the Pilgrims wore colorful, embroidered clothing, nor were they grimly sober the way they always look in the paintings. They loved to laugh and sing, to play games, and drink nut brown ale, up to a gallon a day if they could get it. And a gallon of ale a day is not conducive to being grim. We learn these things from a director of Plymouth Plantation, a faithful reconstruction of the Plymouth colony as it looked in the 1620s. He points out that the only eyewitness account we have of what we have always taken to be the first Thanksgiving Day was written by a pilgrim named Edward Winslow, who talks about four men being sent out for game birds after the harvest, and how they killed so many in one day that with a little extra, it served the whole company for almost a week. There was some target shooting and a visit from nearby Indians, including the great Indian King Massasoit and about 90 of his warriors, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted. And they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor. For the Pilgrims, this almost certainly continued a tradition they had known back in England called a harvest home. So the staff of the present day Plymouth Plantation honor that celebration on their stage each September, and pay little attention to what the rest of us are doing on the fourth Thursday in November. The November business came long, long afterwards when Abraham Lincoln issued this proclamation in 1863. The year that is drawing toward its close has been filled with the blessing of fruitful fields and healthful skies. No human counsel hath devised, nor has any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God. It has seemed to me fit and proper that they should be solemnly, reverently, and gratefully acknowledged with one heart and one voice by the whole American people. I do therefore invite my fellow citizens in every part of the United States to set apart and observe this day as a day of thanksgiving and praise to our beneficent Father who dwelleth in the heavens. There was one more wrinkle. In 1939, Franklin Roosevelt proclaimed that Thanksgiving Day was to be celebrated 1 week earlier. His purpose was to help business by making the shopping period between Thanksgiving and Christmas a little longer. 2 years later, Congress moved it back to the fourth Thursday, and it has been there ever since, getting a little less religious and a little more secular all the time. In recent years, we have added the phenomenon of football so that during a good part of my life, Thanksgiving Day afternoon was solemnly dedicated to the game between Oklahoma and Nebraska. When pro football joined the holiday menu, there was the next-door neighbor who was a Redskins fan at a time when his team was playing its arch rival, the Dallas Cowboys. He had a problem. He told his wife he didn't want to have dinner before the game because he was too excited, but he hated to wait until after the game because if the Redskins lost in the last few seconds, which they did, he would totally lose his appetite. He suggested that dinner might be served at halftime. His wife, who by this time was not sure what she had ever seen in her husband, reluctantly agreed. So after she had worked many hours preparing the turkey and trimmings, her husband said grace, ate his dinner, and was back in front of the TV set in 9 minutes. There are those in the neighborhood who say the marriage has not been the same since. The Pilgrims, those early Congregationalists, had no football games to watch, but then they probably didn't have turkey either. They certainly didn't have cranberry sauce or sweet potatoes or creamed onions. They preferred roast goose, venison, stewed pumpkin, sweet stuffing, frumenti, something on the order of rice pudding, and ale. Lots of ale. They made it through that first terrible winter largely because some friendly Indians who were excellent farmers helped them. It is one of the ironies of history that there are thousands of Indians today who need all the help they can get from us. Perhaps we should think of them on Thursday if we happen to remember the Mayflower and its little band of believers. We are not Lutherans or Episcopalians. Those pilgrims were our direct ancestors. Surely it would not be too much to ask from a congregational pulpit that we take a moment on Thursday to be truly grateful for the things that bless our lives, that we keep the day from being only a secular holiday, a chance to be off work and watch the ball games. I'm not sure it matters so much what our list is of things to be grateful for, so long as we have one. I don't know how it works for you, but when I forget to be grateful, it's because always I have forgotten how lucky I am, how good things are despite the minor illnesses and the petty little grievances. I forget when I get too wrapped up in myself, and I remember again when I get out of myself. A thing that happened to me, for example, last Sunday afternoon when I was with the choir at a nursing home. I was impressed that these very busy people with all sorts of things they would prefer to do on a beautiful day, took time to sing in that place, where there were more of us, perhaps, than there were of them, and where a few of them were asleep. But not all of them. There were also some alert and intelligent people listening, a couple of whom said later, "We've had a lot of different church groups come on Sunday afternoons, but none of them could sing like this. You are by far the best we've had." You would have been proud of Bob Scott and Helen Griffin and the choir, as I always am, and you would have realized, as all of us did, that whatever we did for that frail audience was nothing in comparison to what we did for ourselves. Realizing again how lucky we are, how wonderful it is to be strong and well. It is always in the best interest of music that I not sing at times like that. So I sat in the audience and listened and looked around and counted my own blessings. I saw the worn old heads dropped down on frail chests, and the still handsome older man taking tender care of his wife who had had a stroke. And I thought over and over, just a little while ago, these people fell in love, had children, dreamed their dreams, did their work faithfully, packed up with excitement for vacations, and now life has sifted down to days that are all alike, until on one of them, in the afternoon, they get a short wheelchair ride down the hall to hear some visitors sing. Otherwise, day after day of patient waiting. I came out into the sunlight so thankful that everything the rest of that day seemed touched with glorious light. If you need to rediscover how many good things fill your days, how wonderful life is, talk to a man who is in prison, spend a couple of hours in a hospital, visit a nursing home. We do not welcome tragedies like Hurricane Hugo or the California earthquake, but for a while at least, certain good things grow out of them. And one is that priorities clear up. Losing a shiny new car to a tumbling cascade of bricks is nothing, so long as the family is safe. Losing a house may be a financial and psychic disaster, but it can be borne if those who share the house, the ones you love, have survived. The inventory of a grocery store is secondary to the people who stock the shelves. We learn what matters, who matters. That huge overload on the telephone lines after the quake was not caused by people trying to check on the stock market. It may have annoyed some who had settled in to watch the World Series on television, but I thought it was wonderful to see spectators and athletes discover what is important and what is not. When the ground began to heave and toss, the players looked for their wives and children in the stands, found them, and hugged them, because they were what mattered. Everybody suddenly remembered that even the World Series is a trivial item compared to family and friends. One night last week, when we were having a wedding rehearsal in this church, someone came in during a lull and begged me to come outside and look at the full harvest moon shining over that meadow next door with the ripe round bales of hay and the stubble of native grass edged with silver in the moonlight. It looked like somebody's picture postcard of a setting for a congregational church about to celebrate Thanksgiving. We used to sing a song in church when I was a child called Bringing in the Sheaves. I hardly knew what the word meant, but there was a time when everybody knew all about sheaves, when Thanksgiving really was a time to be grateful for a harvest that could keep man and beast alive through the coming cold winter. Ellen Goodman was perceptive, as she always is. A few years back, when she wrote that we have a different kind of harvest these days at Thanksgiving, a harvest of family. We are the ones gathered in like sheaves. A son flies in from Boston, a brother drives down from Kansas City, daughters come from Texas and California, a harvest of people who have gotten scattered all over the country. Our pilgrim ancestors celebrated a whole community. Families were taken for granted. They had not scattered. But the community, that was something else. They needed community desperately to sustain them in a huge, unknown, and dangerous continent. When they sang and feasted and danced at their harvest home festival, they were one extended family. We have cultivated privacy until we long at times for the ceremonies and rituals of intimacy. The definition of home, even, has been reduced to that famous line of Robert Frost's that says, home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. It is, in Ellen Goodman's words, an image of family as a last resort, a place where you might have to go and they would have to take you in. We prefer, she says, to believe that home is where, when you want to be there, they want you. So we get together, if not this Thanksgiving, then the next one, and tell the old stories again, because some of the kids will have gotten big enough to hear them for the first time, and we pass on recipes and hear about Uncle Frank, who was eccentric, and for a time experience that strange contract that is meant by the word family. We go home for the holidays for the reason we all go home. We don't want to become strangers. For your families and mine, and for the family that built this house beside the harvest field, we offer up together on this day our heartfelt thanks.